If you don't like capitalism and you don't like state socialism, what do you want?
And there is a great deal of new construction of new institutions, new forms, new cooperatives, new worker-owned companies that's happening all over the country.
This is the Gar Alperovitz Podcast, a regular look at the ideas of historian and political economist Gar Alperovitz as he explores strategies to democratize wealth and empower workers and communities.
It is a real pleasure, first of all, to welcome you as one of the ministers that serves this congregation to this event. I welcome you to the Unitarian Universalist Church of Annapolis. Our special guest this afternoon is Dr. Gar Alperovitz, who is currently the professor of political economy at the University of Maryland. He holds the Lionel Bowman Chair. Prior to teaching at the University of Maryland, he has a long list of diplomas and credits that are really extremely impressive. Part of that was that he was a legislative director in both the House and the Senate of the United States Congress. At one time, he was a special assistant to the Department of State. He is a founding principal of the Democracy Collaborative at the University of Maryland. He grew up in the Midwest. He received his BA degree at the University of Wisconsin, and then an MA from the University of California, and a PhD from the University of Cambridge in England. He is a political economist and a revisionist historian. He has many books to his credit, and the book that perhaps is most relevant to our conversation today is this book, America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. And if you purchase it and then bring it up here later on, he'd be happy to autograph it for you. When I received my copy of America Beyond Capitalism, I found something stuck inside the book. I always like to leave things in my books. Hopefully someday somebody will get it and discover a little prize. And the little prize waiting for me in my copy was a letter from one of my mentors, Harvey Cox, who teaches at Harvard Divinity School. And it was a letter to someone else after Cox had read Beyond Capitalism. And here is in part what he wrote. At a time when many of us have an ominous feeling that our liberties are in fact being undermined, our democracy threatened, and the wealth that belongs to all of us recklessly squandered, it would be hard to overstate the timeliness of this engaging book. Further, for those of us who believe that congregations and other communities have a vital role to play, other than simply functioning as charity conduits, this book advances some encouraging ideas and proposals. These are not just theoretical ideas, however, but emerge from the many years of work that Dr. Alperovitz has done. Something he suggests is already underway. If we only look around, we do not need to start from scratch. I think you will find very engaging what Dr. Alperovitz has to say. What's amazing is that letter was written in 2005. 7 years later, it reads as though it could have been written yesterday, as does his book, as does Dr. Alperovitz's knowledge, awareness, passion, and compassion for this topic. It's a real pleasure to have Dr. Alperovitz with us today. Please welcome Dr. Gar Alperovitz.
Thanks for that very warm and generous welcome. I'm pleased to be here for many reasons, including above all my daughter Carrie and her partner Jamie are here and members of this congregation. So it's a special honor to be here. I want to give you a suggestion. I'm going to give you five or six suggestions, and so you can disregard the ones you don't like. But the first one is how to listen to this talk, maybe. So there are different ways to hear a lecture, since I lecture to students all the time. My suggestion is one question to ask is not, you know, is he right and wrong? Of course you have to do that. Is it interesting? Sure. Has he presented some new ideas? Maybe. The suggestion I make is that you listen to it with this ear. What in the world can I specifically do because of what he suggested? So I'm interested in that question myself, not simply giving a lecture. Now, a variation on that question is, what might we do as a group of people, say five friends, if we got together and decided to do something. So that's another way to listen to it. As you may know, I'm speaking to the person in your chair, so I'm sorry to bother you with these problems. Another way to say it is, what could we do as a congregation? When I see this group here, and my daughter was asking me what I wanted to do before I came, so I just want to see who's here. What I see is power. I see enormous power. I'm a fan of Margaret Mead's famous line that, she says, we're just a small group. Nothing ever begins without small groups, like the six people who decided to sit in to start the civil rights group, the civil rights movement, and the women's movement, et cetera. So in the 1960s, what I've just said would be laying a heavy rap on you. It's a question about responsibility. So the second thing I want to say, that's all by way of my introductory business. The second thing I want to say is, we all know that there is something deepening in problematic about the way the American economy and the American political system is developing. Occupy has brought that, the Occupy movement has brought that to our attention. But it would not have been able to do that if most people hadn't sensed that something was profoundly wrong. And at a moment in history when people actually sense that something is profoundly wrong, that it isn't simply the next election, that there are profound difficulties, that there may be systemic difficulties, that's a moment when reflection on where we are historically matters, and where we might go, and what we might do. So what I'd like to frame the discussion not simply as what's wrong, but how we might understand it in history, and then what does it mean in terms of what we might do. And the final word of introduction is this, that there are two different ways to think about some of the specific things that my good friend Harvey Cox mentioned, concrete things that are going on just under the surface that might be starting places. One is, many of them are very good things to do anyway. And there's a lot of interesting co-ops and worker-owned companies and different strategies emerging that the press doesn't cover. Another is, and this is the historical part, that just possibly what's emerging may be laying the foundations for the next great progressive era. That's a different way of thinking about things. That's saying that there may be something slowly building up to which we can contribute, possibly, that is establishing conditions that might become transcendent. That's not simply what happens in the next election, not simply what policy some policymaker might advance, though both are important. It's a different question of how we see ourselves and our time and our nation historically. Very hard thing to do. Very hard thing to back off and say there might possibly be a systemic transformation as a possibility. So I'm going to drop that out there in the beginning as well, because there are many things you can do without taking that seriously that matter and are important to people. So simply by way of introduction, as we know, and I won't give you an awful lot of statistics, over the last 30 years, real wages have simply not increased more than tiny fractions, and now they've gone down substantially. 30 years, no change in real wages for all intents and purposes. At the same time, the top 1% has gone from having roughly 10% of the income in the United States to 24%. Now, it's gone back down a little bit since it peaked because of the Great Recession. But think about that. A society in which not only is there stability at best, but the increase in income in society has virtually all gone to the top. Something very odd, something profoundly unusual is going on. Another way to look at it, there are the top 1% of the United States population owns just under 50% of the investment capital. That one has to sink in. It's very hard to grasp what that means. 1% owns half of the factories, farms, mines, stores, all the productive investment, the stocks and bonds, the productive capital. 1%. That's a medieval number, and I don't mean that rhetorically. That's a number about how the property was organized and the power relationships were organized in medieval society. So you have to get a different perspective on where we are, and that's one way to do it. So if you even look at other numbers, the top 400 individuals in America, I didn't believe this number until it was checked several times, 400 people in a society of 316 million people own more wealth in general, that's including houses and cars and everything beyond the stocks and bonds, than the bottom half of the society taken together. Let it sink in. Along with those economic, and there are more and more statistics like that, along with those economic statistics goes political power and substantial political power. We know historically, as a very broad generalization, that a great deal of power is in systems is organized around the ownership of property. Complex, so I'll oversimplify it. We can get into the discussion, a more complex discussion during the questions. But briefly, in medieval society, the lords who owned the land had the political power, broadly. In state socialism, the state had the property, and along with it, a great deal of political property, power. In traditional capitalism, small business capitalism, the competitive market capitalism, 19th century capitalism, when most capital businesses were actually farm businesses. American farmers were small businessmen, they always are, unlike peasant farmers who operate totally differently, not in a market, they operate in a very different way. But in small business capitalism, there is a breakup of power in quite decentralized forms, a basis of a populist democracy if it works. But in corporate capitalism, our capitalism, the concentrations of power and wealth are now so great as to constitute, I suggest to you, a very different system than any of us have been willing to confront and grasp. That's a very tough thing to ask yourself to think about, because if the problems are systemic, inherent in the structure of the ownership of wealth and the power that attends to it, I'll say it again. If the problems are systemic, inherent in the structures of power and ownership that we have, then either the system has to be changed somehow, whatever that means, or you can't change the patterns much. That doesn't mean there aren't good things to do, and a lot of people are in pain, and there are many good things to do. But the broad trends, the ones that produce the income and wealth distributions, the ones that produce ongoingly, 13 to 14 and now 15% of the population in poverty, half of all black children. By the way, in poverty, I mean the technical definition of poverty in the United States, which all experts understand is arbitrary and foolish. The number would be at least double 15% if we use the standards common throughout the advanced industrial world, half the median. There's a very strange story about how our poverty line was drawn, but it means that what you think of as poverty in most other countries, if we use their standards, we'd have twice as many, and black children would be that many more. So if those are the ongoing patterns, the long trends, and we could also say the same thing with regard not only to what's happened in the environment and climate change, the long trends are not changing or going down, then you either have to change the structure of the system or it doesn't change. So, is that possible? And besides, what does it mean? What would it mean if you don't like capitalism, you don't like state socialism, what do you want? I think what's happening, in part as a result of the deepening economic problems that facing the country, in part result of the politics that's going on that many people see as arbitrary, foolish, dishonest often. In part, there is a conversation that's growing up around saying, where are we really going And that's why it's so important that people had such a profound reaction to the Occupy movement. Is there a new way forward? And my suggestion, and I've been lecturing around the country, is that people are now open to this very strange question. If you don't like capitalism, if you don't like socialism, what do you want in a realistic way rather than a rhetorical way? So that's another strange idea, that there might be a realistic rather than rhetorical way to think about changing the system. America Beyond Capitalism is the name of the book I wrote. So how do you get at that? Well, there are two or three ways that I get at it and ways I would suggest you might think about it. Most of us were brought up, I think, in this room. I may be wrong, but I sense a progressive tone to the audience and tone to the kinds of remarks I've heard. I was brought up in Wisconsin working for liberal congressmen and senators, Senator Gaylord Nelson, the founder of Earth Day. I was his legislative director. The model we were working on and the model that this particular era of our history has been based upon, and the model, the systemic model, that is common throughout the advanced industrial world today still, essentially operates on these very simple principles, that the organization of power and wealth is left to the large corporations by and large, with peripheral small business and so forth, but the central institution is a large corporation. And then progressive movements attempt to refine it, either clean up the poverty or tax and spend, progressive programs, regulate. I was involved with regulations, particularly in the environmental area. Tax some of the people at the top, spend more for poverty. That's typically called either a liberal or progressive solution in this country. In Europe, it's called social democracy. But the organization of power and wealth is left with the corporation, by and large, and you attempt to balance it through political action and social movements. Conventional idea. We've all been brought up that way. That's what I've spent many, many decades of my life working on. That's a particular systemic design. And my suggestion to you is that design is now faltering before your very eyes. And there are specific reasons for it. We could go into them in some depth, but I'll give you a couple short ones. The easiest one to understand is that in all advanced systems, the way that thing was made to work were powerful labor movements supported progressive action and were the core muscle in the progressive alliance. Environmentalists, social groups, others were allowed, and feminist groups and so forth, but at the heart of the system where the money and organizational power is and was, this has been studied endlessly by political economists, organized labor has always been the key to keeping the balance, or as John Kenneth Galbraith talked about it, the countervailing power in the progressive movements was always at the core, essentially, labor. So one way to think about why that system is decaying before your eyes is that the labor movement in the United States has declined radically over the last 30 years. For better or worse, I think worse, but nonetheless, what must be confronted is a trend that goes from 35% of the labor force organized in unions to just 11.8%, the latest numbers, 7%, 6.9% in the private sector, and declining. So if you look at that number, we could give you some other things that have been going on. Globalization is another factor. An odd factor in the United States, this is really odd, people have to wrap their heads around this one. For a long time, for very odd reasons, the Civil War made very, very conservative groups in the South carry the banner of Democrats. They should have been Republicans all along, if they had, in terms of their ideology. But because Lincoln was a Republican, it's very aberrant. When that system collapsed in the Civil Rights Movement, broke it apart, the real power of the regroupment of the South where it belonged in Republican lines came forward. And it's another reason why the weakness of the progressive coalition has gone down in the Democratic. Under Roosevelt, you could sort of keep the South on the backs of black people, you could keep the South within the Democratic Party electing Democratic presidents. That's over as well. But the most important thing to keep your eye on is the trend in labor, because that tells you where the weakening is going on. It also tells you why very conservative groups in Wisconsin and in Indiana and Ohio are trying to really put the death knell into the labor movement, because they know where the political power base is. So what I've just said to you, if you, you know, think about it a little bit, is that not only is the system in decay, the main power base institutionally is in decay. Big trouble. So then the question becomes, is there any way out of this box? And what's interesting to me, and I've been studying it for a long time, and what Harvey was commenting about, is that the system is generating both disillusionment. People are sense something's wrong. That's not always happening in politics. And they sense that, you know, the next election may not do it. Don't know what to do with that. There's also huge pain levels building up around the country and growing problems that are not being solved, but are also generating odd experimentation because of the pain. And that's one of the things we study at the Democracy Collaborative. I'll give you a website, www.community-wealth, put the dash in. And what we've begun to notice is that if the organization of power, broadly speaking, in systems is significantly related to who owns wealth and the institutional base of that, what we've begun to notice is a process in many parts of the country. The press doesn't cover it. They don't have the time or the money or the interest. The press is decaying as well. There's a process in which a preliminary developmental trend of democratizing the ownership of wealth in very American ways is happening. Very odd. Or there are traditional organizations that are being built on that the central characteristic of which is changing the ownership of wealth in a form that democratizes its ownership. So this is not state socialism. It's not corporate capitalism. It's very American, and it's coming out of pain. And as the pain deepens and as ideas spread, and we can get into, there's a very interesting process of how ideas are spreading now on the internet. I just had one example this morning from Milwaukee. We're seeing more and more people saying, we've got to do something different, and actually doing it. So let me give you some of the examples that are, or just some of the numbers that tell you about the range of possibilities. There were 13 million Americans who are now, today, involved as owners of worker-owned companies in the United States. Worker-owned companies, that's a different way of owning capital. And they've been studied to death by academics. They're more productive. They have better pension systems. They stay put. People living in a community don't get up and leave the way corporations often do when you give them a big tax break and then they move on. That's 13 million people in worker ownership of the means of production in America. Quite ordinary. And there it is on the ground and expanding. Odd. Why is that happening, and why has it happened? There are 130 million Americans who today are members of co-ops and credit union co-ops. What's that? It's one person, one vote, democratic ownership of banking systems and co-ops, credit unions. Very conventional. 40% of Americans have that experience. There are 4,000 to 5,000 neighborhood corporations, nonprofit, many of which, the purpose of which, is to own and develop neighborhood land, housing, and businesses. 4,000 to 5,000. There are 25% of American electricity today. This is an odd one. There are 2,000 public utilities, city-owned utilities, city-owned businesses, if you like. 25% of American electricity is socialized, meaning utilities and co-ops. produce 25% of the electricity. There are hundreds of land trusts developing around the country. Land trusts in the 1960s, there was one that anybody knew about. There are hundreds of them now. That's either a nonprofit form of ownership of land in the city. Conservation land trust is a different thing. The purpose of a land trust in the city is to develop land and housing in a way that preserves moderate and nonprofit housing and keeps gentrification under control. There's also commercial land trust development, but it is essentially a nonprofit ownership, a democratized ownership, or a city ownership of land. Again, developing in odd ways around the country. An economic example. In Washington, D.C., and in many other cities, a big public investment goes into setting up mass transit. At the exits of a mass transit system, huge public investment, property values typically rise tremendously because a lot of people come there. So that's a good place for retail outlets and stores. That used the typical previous pattern around the country was, you know, some developer would make a lot of money out of it, and you try to tax some part of it back for the city. Now what happens in many cities is the city owns the land and makes the profit and then leases it out and captures those rents that it created out of its investment. I'll give you another example. In Sarah Palin's Alaska, unlike Texas, as many of you probably know, the oil revenues are distributed equally as a matter of legal right. So currently, or I'm not sure what the number is this year, but it's typically been around $2,000 a person, meaning a family of husband, wife, and three kids got a $10,000 check from the socialized resource, if you like. I could go on and on with this, but what's happening at different levels around the society we're experiencing and we're seeing is this kind of developmental process, which in a very American way begins to change the actual ownership on the ground in ordinary, non-rhetorical, non-ideological, but very practical terms, in large part out of pain. And with it also, and this I think is more significant as well, is a different idea. The idea is that just possibly principles that arise out of these changes in everyday life might suggest a vision and principles for systemic change that goes beyond these strange false choice between corporate capitalism and state socialism. Look at yourself in, you know, look inside. Most of us have been taught by Margaret Thatcher and everybody else, TINA, T-I-N-A, there is no alternative. Most of us have bought that. Probably one or two people in this room. I'm suggesting to you, that's ridiculous. Why are those the only two alternatives? You know, come on. There might be other ways to organize an extremely wealthy, highly productive economic system than those two alternatives, and we don't have to accept that. But out of this kind of experimentation, quite apart from my opinion, we're beginning to see models of ideas that are radically decentralized, yet deal with efficient production and suggest principles that might be advanced further, maybe, by a political movement. I said at the outset we may be in the prehistory before a transformative era, not necessarily yet in the history, by which I meant the following. If you look at how the New Deal occurred, I'm from Wisconsin, a lot of this happened in Wisconsin, but many other states, for 25 years before the New Deal actually implemented national solutions, the experimentation that developed labor law and health and safety law and many other pieces of legislation that became the New Deal were developed in agonizing processes at the state level first, step by step. So that's another way to think about a period that might be the prehistory of a systemic possibility. Another way to think about it, the women's movement in the 19th century, seeking the right to vote, state by state by state, by agonizing state by state, built up the power in the prehistory before the vote was achieved. As I write in this book, my heroes are the civil rights movement, civil rights leaders in Mississippi in the 1930s and 40s. Why? Because they knew people had to establish the prehistory of what came later. Awfully easy to join a political and social movement when it's moving. Very hard to do to help lay the groundwork before everyone else has joined on the train and said, hey, why aren't you here? So another way to think about this period, just possibly, you know, just allow this one to kind of maybe be a possibility. Just possibly, I know it's not easy, we may actually be living, I think we are living, in the possible prehistory of the next great transformation. And then the question is, I said possible. If it is it's possible, then what is it that we can do? Well, we can do nothing for one thing, but if you care about these matters, then it turns out there's a lot you can do trying to advance the principles that are emerging to democratize wealth and ownership as best you can. I said possible. People would like very much to know that either it can't go that way or that it will go that way. You know, we all have a vested interest in pessimism. If nothing can be done, why bother? And on the other hand, the idea that you might make massive transformative change, now remember, I'm a historian and a political economist, so you have to discount. The idea that you might be able to make massive historical change, revolutions of one kind or another, as common as grass in world history, the idea that we might be able to make massive change when you can't even get something through the legislature now, that seems crazy. It also may be that precisely because the existing models are failing, they are forcing the development of the prehistory of something different. That's a possibility. That's the possibility I think is most interesting about this time. And it takes us also back to questions of institutional power. I said earlier on, and again, I'm giving you sketches that are more developed in the book, hopefully. I said early on that the institutional muscle of the labor movement had declined behind the power base of the progressive or social democratic structure of managing advanced systems. One way to think about what I'm talking about is the democratization of an economy and a political economic system in large order, so that, for instance, there are many states, 14 at last count, that are now taking not local things, but more advanced things to a different level. The state of North Dakota has a state-owned public socialized bank. I'm using that word to just nudge you a little bit. State Bank of North Dakota. 14 states have said, why do we send our money to Wall Street? Why can't we set up a state bank? Several cities are experimenting with that. We'll see if they get any far. San Francisco has about $2 billion in float money, in the money that it has, instead of depositing it in the Bank of America, why not deposit it in a credit union or a public bank? There's a proposal by some alderman there. Same thing in Portland, Oregon. People beginning to look at larger structures, banks, public banks being another one. Another larger structure, there are about 15 states now saying we really have to start looking at single payer. And healthcare. And the only way that's going to happen is state by state by state by state building up, because it's going to be attacked no matter what. But at the national level, we've got to rebuild from the bottom up. So moving to the state level and laying groundwork for much larger institutional change. I think we're going to see, and most financial experts agree, left, right, and center, I think we're going to see national financial crises again and again. And at one point or another, the big banks are going to be spotlighted in a different way than they were this time. They are ripping apart the regulations. The lobbyists in Washington are cracking open all the regulatory powers. There's so many loopholes developing. No one expects the Dodd-Frank legislation to control them. And when the next big financial, not if, when the next big financial crisis happens, the political anger will probably be even greater than before. So at the national level, you may see you may see some of those banks broken up. And when they're broken up, they probably will regroup. The big fish will eat the little fish. And at some point, some of them will be taken over. The possibility of public nationalization is very high. The U.S. government had 32% of the shares in Citigroup and didn't exercise the votes. It did have the same, it controlled AIG and didn't exercise the votes. Those were effectively nationalized. So I think we're going to see very large order changes there. If you want to pursue this even further, if the economic crisis gets deeper, we did, in fact, nationalize Chrysler and GM. We put a lot of money into them, and when they start making profits, we gave them back. I think that we're in a period where we may see also some things at the national level developing over time as the pain level grows and as the larger institutional problems develop. But that's for the longer haul, and we could get into that. What is much more interesting to me is the developmental process at the grassroots level and at the ground level, where people actually themselves can do things. So let me get back to the institutional problem and just come at it one other different way. It's this way. I'm talking about models that begin to offer a different vision of who should own the wealth of the society in a democratic way. That has a systemic design implicit in it. Another way to think about it is these are institutions that also can and do begin to empower politics. They have the same potential in a very different way and are beginning to show up in cities. I'll tell you about one in a minute. In cities and in states that offer an institutional power base to slowly augment and replace the declining labor power base. Now, that perspective is different from systemic design, something beyond corporate capitalism and democracy. That's about how you give added power to help along the building of a political coalition by building institutional power. So we're beginning to see that. And let me tell you about one of the most interesting advanced representations of that we've seen. The city of Cleveland is a city where our group has done some work, and this will give you an idea of what can be done any place, and indeed many other cities are now copying what I'm about to tell you. The pain levels in the city of Cleveland are as follows. The city has gone from 900,000 to 400,000 in the last 30 years. The neighborhood that we're talking about in this particular example has a median income of 18,000. It's a black neighborhood, largely. 40% unemployment. Pretty rough neighborhood. On the other hand, in that same area, there are big, big hospitals and universities. Cleveland Clinic is one of them. And they sit in the middle of this terrible area. Notice that they're sometimes called anchor institutions because they can't leave. They're anchored, not like big corporations that come and go. They're anchored. Every city has them. Baltimore's got a lot of them. By and large, these are very wealthy organizations. By and large, they depend heavily on public funds, Medicare, Medicaid, educational funds, and there they are. In this little neighborhood of 40,000 people in Cleveland, they buy $3 billion of goods and services a year. $3 billion. That's in addition to construction and in addition to salaries, just what they buy. None of it from that neighborhood. So a light bulb has gone on, and in that particular neighborhood, and now in many cities, why couldn't they buy locally? And if they did, why could they not buy, instead of making one small businessman wealthy, or someone who will make money and then run to the suburbs, why not purchase from worker-owned cooperatives that are anchored in the community that will stay there and try to rebuild the community? Well, that's what's happening in Cleveland. The so-called evergreen co-ops, I think we're going to see a video of one of them, and happening in many cities and could happen in this area. There are a group of co-ops, worker-owned companies, linked together with a nonprofit corporation and a revolving fund that are producing and selling, not entirely, but largely to these big anchor institutions that exist there. So what you've got in this case is a community building structure based on worker ownership and nonprofit structure. The goal is not to make just some workers wealthy, but to build the whole community. So when they make profits, they profits go back into the revolving fund. New co-ops are started, and they're linked together so they can't leave, so they're building the community. The Evergreen co-ops are, let's see, there are a number of things going on right now, but three interesting examples. The solar installation worker co-op of this group is online to produce more solar installation than exists in the entire state of Ohio in the next 2 years. These are not little co-ops. These are significant scale. Some of you may know about the Mondragon co-ops in the Basque Country of Spain. If not, we can talk about that. They're designed in part on that model, which is a 100,000 people model, very effective, well-studied, large-scale, advanced research, high-tech, et cetera, et cetera. So these are designed in part on that. Secondly, there is a about-to-open hydroponic solar-empowered greenhouse. And again, the scale is of interest, worker-owned. 3 million heads of lettuce a year. That's the scale of that operation. And there is a industrial-scale laundry that is operating. It's the greenest laundry perhaps in the Midwest, certainly in that part of the Midwest. It uses about a third of the water and a third of the heat that other laundries. And it's aimed in part at the hospitals and universities. And they're online to put on 2 new businesses a year in this model. So get the model. This takes you a little bit beyond worker ownership and worker co-ops. It's a next step advance and takes you to using the power of large institutions that have taxpayer money in them to concentrate and rebuild and change the ownership of wealth that results from the economic activity. I just saw one this morning, this video that came in, that Milwaukee is now looking at that. There are going to be three in the Washington, D.C. area. There are a group there that the Washington, I think, area funders has funded the development of 3 different ones, and they're looking for locations right now. Pittsburgh is underway doing something very similar. There's another one in Atlanta, Oakland, California, Richmond, California. This thing is beginning to spread because people see that, let me put it this way, people see that the system is failing in these cities, and the old ways don't work, and all of a sudden a new model that transforms the ownership and democratizes it becomes American and easy to do and changes the vision, not easy to do, but doable, and changes the vision of what might be possible. So I'm coming at it another way, that in fact, if you look at on-the-ground experimentation around the country that you don't see covered in the press, check that website, community-wealth, you will find thousands and thousands of things of the kind I'm talking about burgeoning up at the local level now. And people don't know about it, although the word is spreading fast. One of the most exciting things to me when I look at this is that over the last 30 years, there also has been a developmental process. And I'm going to give you just a little bit more of this and then come to the end. I happen to work with a steelworkers union in the south of, in a different part, in Youngstown, Ohio, in 1977. Now, it's a very important story in one sense. It has more to do with the developing process that I was talking about as the prehistory process. In 1977, 5,000 people were thrown out of work on one day in the Youngstown Sheet and Tube Company. In 1977, some of you people with gray hair like mine will remember, that was a big story. It was a national story because people weren't losing their jobs like that around the country. Now it's conventional. Everybody knows that happens all the time. So it made the national press. The religious leaders in that area and the steel workers got together and they said, why can't we run this mill? Remember that small group thing I was talking about? And they got their act together. They developed a political coalition that included Republicans and Democrats throughout the state, including the conservative governor, Rhodes, at the time, Republican. They got the support of the national religious community. They did their homework, they did their politics, they did their technical work, they hired people to do advanced, I was the economic architect for it, they hired consultants that we brought in, the top steel experts of the country, came up with a coherent, intelligent, and profitable plan, and the Carter administration at that time offered $200 million in loan guarantees for it. So it was ready to go. They also understood, it's very interesting, the religious leadership was very sophisticated. One bishop in particular, Bishop Malone. Even if they failed, if they did their work well, they could spread the word of a new idea. They were hip. They understood that. They did fail. It's a long story about how some of the big steel companies, and at that time the International Labor Union, cut it down. But in the state of Ohio, and here's a lesson for those of you who want to think about those civil rights workers in Mississippi. In the state of Ohio, step by step by step, there are now more worker-owned companies per capita than any place else. And if you look at this model in Cleveland, which is more advanced and more complex and more innovative, and there will be more beyond that, that's only the first step, you'll find that it's built itself upon the experience that had developed in the state of Ohio to get to that point. That's the process we're talking about. The development of ideas, experimentation, courageous people, institutional change, and then the advanced, sophisticated, more sophisticated at larger levels. And you can see it operating in Ohio today over the last 30 years. That's the process is beginning also to take on political shape. All I've talked about so far is building institutions that have a different coloration, a different structure, a different form. Senator Sherrod Brown is now about to introduce legislation to expand the model I'm talking about to other parts of the country. And the Steelworkers Union, which was against worker ownership in Ohio in 1977 at the national level, not at the local level, has now turned around and is sponsoring worker ownership. That's the pattern of people learning a new idea, realizing that the old ways don't work, and being forced to innovate into something new that might actually cast a transformative shadow. Well, where does that take us? I'm coming to the end, so I'm going to say, I suspect, tell me if I'm wrong, I suspect that in the state of Maryland, an extremely interesting state, I think really one of the most interesting states in the country because of its openness politically and because of its history, there are enormous opportunities if you look at history over time. You were the first state to, Senator Jamie Raskin, that passed legislation to set up a B Corps. That's another one of these forms. People know what B Corps is? That's a new legal form. You have it in Maryland. You're the leader. Again, in a different way to change the meaning and ownership of property in business terms, if most corporations, if you want to spend a lot of the corporation's money on behalf of some social project, you are subject to challenge legally by the stockholders. That's not what corporations do. You're supposed to fulfill the obligations to the stockholders, and so you can't do much. You can do token little things that are good business relations, but you can't do serious funding for things. A B Corp is a form of corporation that changes that regulation so that when people invest, they know that some of the profits, or a substantial part, might be used for social purposes. And you have them in this state, and there are four or five other states that have them now, and a number of states pending. Again, changing these ownership patterns so that the use of capital can move in a different way. I think Maryland is extremely interested, and particularly as the economy deepens and the problems get worse, it could well be a place where development on the ground of a serious kind that was sophisticated about what's already out there and could be imported might take on significant power and meaning, and it's also close enough to the Washington Press Corps so that people would have to pay attention. So don't mind me. I'm just a political economist and a historian. I tend to see these things in a long-distance way, but I also see them in terms of the nitty-gritty work that our folks have been doing in places like Cleveland, and in the research that we've done, just accumulating the information. A final word. I think as a historian and a political economist, most of what I do is write books and give lectures, you know, ideas. I'm in the idea world. I don't think ideas matter much at all in history, except sometimes. And when they matter is when things are really falling apart, and people are asking deep questions and need to rethink. And when momentum, which normally governs human affairs, no longer governs, that's the time people begin to say, hey, something is wrong. I need to think of what's really going on here. So I give you my final conclusion. People often say what to do. And I have a suggestion to you. And I think it makes sense for most people, but it's a little bit funny suggestion. Not so funny, it's very serious, actually. Chairman Mao said, power flows from the barrel of a gun. The American women's movement said, no, no, no. Power comes from a half a dozen people getting together, getting some coffee, regularly reading and studying, asking what they can do here in this community now, and then supporting each other and doing it. So thank you very much. Just think about the American women's movement rather than Chairman Mao. Thanks very much.
So we have people again in both aisles. If you just raise your hand, they will try to observe and be as fair as possible. Barbara.
My name is Bob Stewart. I've been proud to spend my adult life working for two different labor unions, AFSCME and UFCW. And we invested a lot of time and effort in Philadelphia in 08, helping to get Obama elected. My question is this: why is the Democratic Party, apparently at a state and national level, so tone deaf in failing to understand the demise of labor's right to organize and its connection to the progressive politics that you talked about? I am so frustrated at being, not just individually, but collectively, the ATM and ground troops for a party that couldn't even and chose not to even bring up the Employee Free Choice Act.
Well, I just, in terms of the bailout of the auto industry, you know, we came in there, saved it, and then at a point, instead of turning it over maybe to employees owning it, Obama rushed to do an initial public offering to get it back out into Wall Street again. I mean, that was very disappointing. I mean, that could have been the great moment, you know, of doing exactly what we were talking about, I would have thought. But maybe that's impractical.
I think the two questions are very similar in some respects. My assessment of why, in the first question, why the Democratic Party and the leadership has not done what I would like to see them do, I think the president made a decision early on. I think it was the wrong decision, that he was going to try to go down the middle and try to reach out rather than do what Roosevelt did, is build that whole coalition that came in with him and sharpen the issues. He's now trying desperately to get back to that position, that politics. I think he could have, at the very outset, for instance, I've worked in politics a long time. I don't blame politicians when there's no space, when they can't move and there's no option. I think he had an option at the very beginning. He came in, he could have said, we've looked at the books, it's far worse what George Bush has left us than anybody believes. I've got both the House and Senate Democratic. And he could have gone in a way that transformed the direction as best he could. He would still run into some of the underlying problems I'm talking about, but he might have tried to help in terms of labor, and that might have been a very powerful way, and he might have taken on the banks or the nationalization issues. I'm not sure where he would have gone on the auto companies. That would have been a step too far. But there was consideration of the banks, because indeed we bought them, and then we gave them away. So I think it is within the power of a president to begin to open that debate. But the ball always lands right back in our lap. They're not going to do anything until they're brought to do it. And that only happens when people like us make that happen, both through politics and through the change in the idea system and the institutions. So there's no escape from this. It's not a friendly rap. It's always comes back here. So I think he could have and might have, and perhaps it pushed harder, might have done more. But none of them are going to do anything serious unless there's a base that's built and the idea system is built. And that's what the prehistory of any political movement's all about. So this is the beginning point of another one. Let's see.
I was really excited to hear your description of what's happening in Cleveland. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the role of education in that scenario, both mechanisms for funding, the function of education, and how that's playing out.
Someone at the beginning used the phrase, we don't have to start from scratch, and it made me start to think about the laws against usury, which I learned as a young person was ancient and had biblical roots. And so that was in the late 60s. And, 10 years later, we have Jimmy Carter repealing the laws against usury. And, somebody who seems to be a religious person ought to have understood that that was a bad idea. And so I'm wondering if a good way to put things right again would be to go back to that so that you can't just make money on money.
Well, on the last one, yes, I think that that would be a good idea. And, the sermon on this side of this, I love being in a church. It always ends up, that won't happen until we make it happen. I mean, politicians, I remember during the 1960s, I was a very young kid working for a liberal congressman, and some of the kids from Harvard who later became, this is the days before SDS, they called it the toxin group at Harvard, and there was a prehistory. They came down saying, well, we've got to get the congressman to change the way that military budget goes. And I basically said to them, look, I love these guys. Some of them have courage, but most of them are mostly like wind vanes. If you blow the wind in the right way, they will move, but they don't move if the wind's coming the other direction. So on the usury laws, yes. But again, it's a political based question whether or not the work is done. And not only because labor's declined, not only just mobilizing folks, that's part of it, but building an institutional base of a different kind that can help augment that power. So, the same thing happened with deregulation. It was the Clinton administration and the Carter administration, not the Republicans. The Republicans did their damage as well. So the other one on education. What's very interesting about the Cleveland model, which has gotten all this attention and press, in that area, the universities are now beginning to give courses on how to do this kind of thing, and the business schools are getting involved and trying to figure out how to do it better. But so far, the universities haven't really, as a whole, jumped to this level. It's really an interesting opportunity for young people to get their universities involved and say, hey, we could do this at this university the way they did South African investment. They could make that part of a demand to start using the university resources. And many universities have hospitals connected with them. It's part of the hospital system. That hasn't happened yet. It could easily be a very interesting demand for lots of folks in the Occupy movement who are students.
You're in a lot of different areas. Around here, and in most places I've been, when you talk about voting for a third party, even when the third party's platform matches what you believe more than any other party, people talk about wasted votes. They will not do it because they believe that if they vote Republican in Maryland, God knows why, because overwhelming Democrat, that they're wasting their vote. Because only if you vote for the Republicans or Democrats are you really using your vote. Do you feel there's a sense that people are going away from that, are thinking about voting for other movements and other parties?
Ed Adams, I'm in the financial area myself, so I'm very interested in how corporations are formed, make money, et cetera. And the B corporations, I had read something recently about that, but I'd like to know more about, are there actually some B corporations that have had time to get formed and actually moving forward, and how do they get the capital together to build their structure?
The last question is the easiest one. If you go to that website, you will find there's resources on B corporations. I think there are something like 300 around the country that are in one form or another. There are, four states that do it formally, and there are several others that are certified in a way that allows them to do some of that. So that's an easy one. The third-party question is a toughie. I think it's very particular. I don't know. Sometimes it makes sense to think about third parties, sometimes not. I don't have a universal view of that. What I do have a view about is that the content of any of these parties needs to change, or the politics is not likely to follow from it. So I'm really oriented to changing the content for the reasons that I've described. I think in some areas it may work. We may well see, the latest speculation is not only that Ron Paul might run, but Gingrich might go. And then what would that happen? And have Romney and Obama split the central vote? Nasty stuff. So I throw that out just to make you worry as I worry.
Hi, this is somewhat of a parochial question for you, I guess. But I'm sort of curious about the recall movement for Scott Walker. And it seems that it's generated by various union interests that are sort of like compelled to fight against the loss of collective bargaining. But I sort of wonder if there's more to it than that, because there just seems to be in other parts of the country such a strong movement in terms of the right to work law and having employee freedom of choice. So, what, you know, from your own point of view, what's going on?
All right. Firstly, I want to say that in my life I've been a huge advocate for open information. And in your lecture, you seem to very much hit on, there's, for me, it seems like an ancient mantra, but for everyone else in the room, think globally, act locally. It rings in a lot of your life, and your lecture very much focuses on the act locally, and I understand that because it's what gives people power. On the concept of globally, I want to know what you think the, what part forgiveness plays in it, because in your lecture, you dance around some of the organizational systems the way they are, namely like the Bank of Internal Settlements, the Federal Reserve, and how all that works. And I've also seen a lot of information come out on that in the last 2 months. And I think that as a whole, we have to see these truths and forgive them as part of in the moving past. So I want to know if you have any thoughts on that sort of concept of forgiveness on a global scale, because the atrocities to man have been so much that it has been hard for people to see through their doubt, and they're just moving it to the side, and like what part truth plays in that.
Good question. Let's do Wisconsin first. I am from Wisconsin. I'm from the slightly decaying industrial town of Racine, Wisconsin, in the southern part of the state, and went to the University of Wisconsin and worked for all these Wisconsin politicians, the progressive politicians. And I've been talking to a lot of people in Wisconsin. What's interesting, it started as a cutback on labor, and the muscle in the fight was labor, but it was far beyond that. It was a very broad-based of kind of fight, because people realized their kids were going to have lousy cutbacks in education. It wasn't only the unions were being attacked, it was the educational system, and it was a system of support through local governments. So the feeling was very, very, very powerfully, it's hard to describe, and I think in Maryland could be that. The sense in Wisconsin was, and this is the language, we don't do things like that in Wisconsin. Kind of a general sense of civic ownership. So that, for instance, let me give you some detail on this. When the Occupy movements of that time, they weren't called that, took over the Capitol, they bought the kind of tape that wouldn't mark the walls because it was their Capitol. And they went first to the janitors and worked with the janitors so no mess would be left, because it was the people's place. So the sense of ownership and political culture is very different. And that's a kind of Wisconsin Midwestern thing, but that's the tone of it. It did have labor as the attack. And notice, now this is the thing to think about in terms of the conversation we've had so far. And they probably will recall Walker, at least according to the reports I've seen. They had 1 million people sign, almost as many people, maybe more people signed recall petitions than voted for him in the last election. So there's a very powerful citizens activity going on. They're looking for a candidate now. Probably Herb Kohl will run. But the thing to notice about Wisconsin, and I want to drive the institutional point, because people, that's the hard place. The labor unions did fight back in Wisconsin and may win, but their fight was entirely defensive. There was nothing going forward. They were holding the line going backwards against the pressures. If you want to reverse the trends in poverty, trends in income distribution, the trends in the environment, the trends in incarceration and liberty and climate change, which are going that way, you've got to do more than become a resistance movement. You've got to be able to build institutional base and power to move the ball forward, and it's not going to be unions, though I support unions as much as possible. That's the argument here. And it's what you used to call in the 60s a heavy rap. That's the argument, that we need to rebuild institutional power or the trends will continue. Forgiveness. I think there is I come at this from Martin Buber, I'm a great fan of Martin Buber's work. I think that there is a powerful role for forgiveness and needs to be, because if the other side is the enemy, you can't ever build a community. So there must be a way of both challenging the practice very strongly and building institutions, but not demonizing the person. So that's the perspective I would have on your question. I'm not sure, I'm sure I don't, haven't answered it entirely, but that's the way I'd come at it.
Hi, I have a question. We're all seems like basic average Annapolis people here. What is something specific call to action that we can do on Monday to help?
Good question.
For several months I've been trying to chase down the statistics on wealth distribution. And after doing that, I came to the conclusion that the 1% owned about one-third of the wealth. I heard you say that 400 people owned half of the wealth, and I'd just like to know what the sources are. We can talk about that afterwards,
sure,
if you like.
And again, it's the... I'm sorry. Yeah, well, that's two questions, right? We'll do the Monday morning one. The wealth statistics, we'll find they're up on that website as well. I think there are. Do you know, John? If the wealth... In any case, if you give me... or give John Duda is our communications director, your email, we'll send it to you. But that number has, that is net worth measure. That's a measure of net worth. That's the latest number on that one. We'll give you the support on that. There are different wealth statistics. Once you get into this, come in different flavors. So investment ownership is one. Net worth is another, different way to get at it. And you can include in the net worth, you can find it with or without the mortgage numbers, it produces a net worth. You can get a gross figure and a net figure. So you got to be careful when you look at wealth numbers, but it's important to ask this question. We'll send you the reference. Monday morning. I don't know anything about Annapolis, and I don't know anything about this region in general. I mean, I know, you know, I don't live here. My suggestion is that, as I said earlier, that the way forward, the best way forward that I know is to call together five or six friends, have some pizza, and maybe read a book, and then ask yourselves, what in the world is the best place to start if we're interested in starting another way? My experience is that if people actually do that, I'm going to give you the hardest challenge I've presented today. There's lots of heavy, hard challenges. The hardest challenge is to spend 1 hour more a week on this. 1 hour. That's what people don't do. So I suggest 1 hour a week, call your friends and see if you can get them together for a discussion of your question. And I suspect if you do that seriously, you'll find five or six different possibilities, and one will make more sense than the other.
Thanks for listening to the Gar Alperovitz podcast. To find articles, interviews, audio, video, and more, go to www.americabeyondcapitalism.com.